Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of November 14th. And we're very happy to have with us Father Michael Suarez. Welcome, Father Suarez.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Father Michael is a Jesuit of the New York province and is also director, is that the correct title?
That is.
At Rare Book School at University of Virginia. Maybe you can introduce Rare Book School to us.
Sure, by all means. Rare Book School was founded at Columbia University in 1983 and moved to the University of Virginia in 1992. And it's an international academy where people come from all over the world to study everything from medieval manuscripts to born digital materials. So we run a series of one-week courses, about 25 courses in the summertime in Charlottesville, 30 hours of instruction and during the week. And we also run satellite courses at places like the Pierpont Morgan Library and the Smithsonian, the Fair-Sackler Galleries there, and the Walters Art Gallery in Baltimore, and so on. And the theory of Rare Book School really is that you can't learn about books and manuscripts or even digital materials by reading about them. You have to examine them closely. Somebody has to, an expert, a world's expert, ideally, has to put a lot of stuff on the table and mediate it to you. And so so we bring in usually the best people in the world to be on our faculty. And then the classes are small. They're limited to 12 people. And they spend a lot of time interrogating the physical object and learning how to read books and manuscripts. They study bindings and typography, the history of photographs, and so on. And we do that by studying the book in history and studying the book as history. So there are courses, for instance, in the hand press period book, or there are courses in the history of the book in colonial and federalist America, or the history of the book in the industrial age in America, and so on. So this summer we were 99% enrolled, which was great, and we had 300 students come and take 25 different courses in Charlottesville. So it's a lot of fun, but we're running this coming October a course on illuminated manuscripts at the Pierpont Morgan Library. That's quite an astonishing thing, because the best collection of illuminated manuscripts in North America is in fact here in New York. Or we're running a course on the medieval book in January at the Walters in Baltimore. And again, for students to be able to come and handle these medieval books and learn how to read them, not just in terms of the linguistic codes, but to learn how to read the physical embodiments and what they tell us. So when I was a graduate student, I studied under the great professor of bibliography and textual criticism at Oxford, a New Zealander named Don McKenzie. And McKenzie said that if you know enough about materials and processes, then if you really know how to look, then every book is alive with the judgments of its makers. And the business of Rare Book School is really a profoundly humanistic endeavor to discern and to learn how to appreciate the human presences in every recorded text.
Now, who are some of the students that are coming to you? I assume librarians, but who else?
It's not just librarians by any means. Collectors, of course, antiquarian book dealers, but also a lot of graduate students and professors. Often we get somebody who might be an associate or a full professor who's you know working away on a project and finds, oh gosh, I don't know much about the history of book illustration. Well, we teach two courses almost every summer, in one on illustration processes, a kind of a technical course, and one on the history of illustrations in books that's a bit more art historical, but very much still allied to, you know, scrutinizing the physical books. We have learned amateurs as well. This summer, my youngest student was 19 years old, and an undergraduate. She came and took two courses. My oldest student was an 85-year-old, a former president of the Grolier Club, who said, there's an area I don't know about and I'd really like to learn. So it's a combination of people who are librarians, collectors, dealers, conservators, professors, graduate students. It really runs the full gambit.
And I think you mentioned this before, but it's an important point. Although you're called Rare Book School, you're not just dealing in rare physical books, you're also dealing with the whole kind of digital revolution.
Absolutely. In my first year, I added to the course catalog. We already had several digital courses, one called TEI in Action, which is about textual markup. But I thought we needed a number of other things, and so we introduced a course called Born Digital Materials Theory and Practice. What happens if you're Emory University and you buy the Salman Rushdie archive for an enormous sum, and it arrives, the truck pulls up, and the driver goes to the back, and he pulls out a single box. and you think it's going to be linear and linear feet of Rushdie's papers. And it's three Apple, or four actually, Apple laptops. And now you have to find a way to make sure this is stable, to make sure you can mediate this to the public, make sure your donors are happy, you know, and so on. So the Born Digital environment and the whole world of digital forensics is something we do. Because digitization is so important, we have a wonderful course also called Digitizing the Historical Record. And it's meant to help the students who take it understand what is lost and what is gained in the digital environment.
Well, maybe you can explore some of that. What are some of the lessons that you've learned and your faculty has learned on that question?
Well, you know, I should begin by saying I'm a great fan of the digital. I use the digital all the time, and I'm delighted to have access to the Bibliothèque Nationale, to the British Library, and so on, you know, when I'm sitting in Charlottesville, Virginia. That's a marvelous thing. But I'm always worried that we're so preoccupied by what we've gained through the advent of the digital that we forget that there are concomitant losses, really. And the loss of the physical, you know, reducing the book to just a kind of a flicker on the screen or a printout, really, you know, we lose information. I know the New York Times recently talked about book fetishism and said, oh, the people who talk about paper and the smell of the book, they're just fetishists and it doesn't really matter. And that's not what I'm talking about. What I think is important is the book is a kind of a totalizing sign system. The book is a congeries or a coalescence of intentions. That's one of the reasons why studying the book is such a humanistic endeavor. Because if you're going to study the book in history, if you're going to do bibliography, not lists of books, but bibliography as a kind of literacy that teaches one how to read the physical object, then to read that object, one has to understand that there's no such thing as Moby Dick or Robinson Crusoe, just, you know, as Call Me Ishmael. You know, Moby Dick only exists in the physical instantiations of Moby Dick. And a book is more than its linguistic codes. A book is also its bibliographical codes, the paper, the type, the leading, the binding, the format of the book. And a book is also always the social codes. And we know this. If you walk into an airport and you see a book with those raised foil metal letters on it, and maybe it has, you know, an AK-47 on it, you know what that book is. You can read the social codes instantly. Or if, you know, in another rack you see you see a sort of a brawny guy, and he's he's only wearing his trousers, and he's embracing a woman who's sort of falling out of her ball gown, and the plantation is burning in the background. You know what that book is. Well, if you were in Venice in 1500 and you went to the bookshop of Aldus Manutius, you could read the social codes in those books too. But we can't, because we don't live in Venice on the sort of crest of the wave of humanistic publishing. And so if we want to understand the Renaissance and the rise of humanism, we have to not just learn how to read the Greek and Latin, which is important, but we have to learn how to read the books as books. And so the digital is great. I use it all the time. I'm the editor-in-chief of something called Oxford Scholarly Editions Online, a 12 or 14-year, millions and millions of pound project. We're going to give full digital editions of every Oxford University Press edition for the last 100 years, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, Euripides, Socrates, all the way up to Born Digital Materials now. It's going to really change the way we work in all sorts of ways. And yes, you'll be able to read it on your iPad. Yes, you'll be able to read it on your phone even. You know, if you want to read Euripides in the subways on your phone, you'll be able to do it. But you could also read Dickens on the subway, you know, in a really reliable edition. But the scholar will be able to interrogate this in other ways. So you know, I'm deeply involved in the digital, but the digital doesn't tell us everything. It's an environment of loss and gain. And so I think some of the things we've learned from working in the digital environment and yet being experts in the book world, being bibliographers, again, people whose livelihood is about the making of books and the reading of books as objects and the stories that they tell, people who can discern the elegant relationships between materialities and meanings, because meanings are always materially mediated. No material, no meaning, because no book. So if we think about the book as a coalescence of intentions, and we're trying to recover those human intentions, then the digital gives us some things that we couldn't get before, but it also is a lossy, as the digital, you know, the computer people would say, it's not a lossless form of translation, it's a lossy or lossful, if you will, form of transmission. And we just want to be mindful of that.
But it seems also that this digital revolution is kind of presenting an opportunity, in that people seem naturally interested in this project, given what's happening in the publishing industry. So, and you were quoted saying this is, rather than a moment of great crisis, this is a moment of rare opportunity.
I absolutely believe that. I think that if you look in the post-Gutenberg era, so Gutenberg first probably starts printing in about 1455, and if you look at the history of manuscripts, it's in the century following Gutenberg that the most elaborate manuscripts are produced. And there are many factors for that, but one of them is that printing made people much more conscious about manuscript form and what it could do and why it was important. And I think we're in a very parallel situation now, that with the advent of the digital, and we know that the digital is here to stay, we know it's going to change the structures of the academy, we know it's going to change structures of human thought, but at the same time, it's raised consciousness about book form and its importance. And so I think that we're at a fantastic moment for the study of the book and the raising of our historical consciousness about the history of printing and publishing.
Now, I know academically you edited a volume on the book, a multi-volume. Maybe you could introduce that to us.
Sure. In 2010, Oxford University Press came out with a 1.1 million word reference book called The Oxford Companion to the Book. And it was written by 398 people from 27 different countries. And it's the first kind of truly global study of printing, publishing, manuscripts, libraries, collecting from around the world. And the book opens with 51 essays on the history of the book in different countries or special subjects like children's books, religious books, and so on. And then the book moves to what the Brits would call an A to Z, which has about 5,200 entries in it. And it's been very well reviewed. It sold out the first press run in under 2 months and has continued to sell very well, both as a digital book and as a print book. The Wall Street Journal said that the Oxford Companion to the book was a font of knowledge where the World Wide Web was but a slot machine, which was fun. So a font of knowledge where the World Wide Web is but a slot machine. Yeah, that was nice ink to get. Yeah. And then I also did a reference book just before that for Cambridge in the Cambridge History of the Book in Britain, and that was a lot of fun too. So there's a lot of great stuff happening right now in bibliography and book history. The Chronicle of Higher Education, believe it or not, called book history a particularly hot field in the humanities. So it's a great time to be studying books.
So it's clear how, you know, your path to Rare Book School from your academic background. As a Jesuit, what brought you to this work?
You know, people ask me that a lot. They say, what the heck is a Jesuit priest doing as the director of Rare Book School? And I suppose, I let me answer by telling a brief story. When the second wave of Jesuits were going into China, they went through Europe collecting books and scientific instruments so that they could go to Peking, as it was then, and share with this great Chinese kingdom the learning of the Western world. And they arrived in the south of China and eventually made their way up to Peking. But they arrived in the south of China in 1623. And in the hold of their ship were 100 scientific instruments and 6,000 volumes. And in 1623, that's an awful lot of volumes. So Jesuits have always been interested, keenly interested in humanistic endeavors. And I believe that by studying words and their transmission, by studying literature, I'm a poetry professor, but also by studying the business of the how words come to their physical being, I find the word in this, but also I see myself as in line with the Jesuit tradition of humanistic scholarship, whereby if we believe that the incarnation is really true, and I believe that with all my heart, then the human is the holy, because in the person of Christ, God came to inhabit a culture and to learn that culture and to live that culture. And so based on the Ignatian principle of finding God in all things, being profoundly engaged in a humanistic enterprise like the scholarship on the book is for me entirely consonant with being a priest and particularly with being a Jesuit.
Well, thank you. Finally, you mentioned that you teach poetry. We should mention you've been on this podcast before. We interviewed you about your Foley Prize-winning poem, Going, I believe it was 2008. A few years ago, one of my favorites that we've published in America. Are you still writing poetry these days?
You know, I am. I'm traveling a great deal, and probably traveling a little bit too much. But I'm giving a lot of lectures and trying to promote Rare Book School. It's a 501c3. It's a little educational nonprofit. It's not actually legally part of the University of Virginia. It's an affiliated foundation. So I'm on the road a lot raising money for the school as well. And so I find that when I'm on planes and in hotels, much as Wallace Stevens was you know, trying to write, I wish I was as good a poet as Wallace Stevens, but much as Wallace Stevens was writing, you know, in his insurance office in between appointments and you know, there are many other cases of people kind of trying to help the muse come in the interstices of their lives. And I find that, that being on the road is sometimes quite conducive. So I've been writing quite a bit lately. Yeah, and with any luck, I'll send a few pieces to America before too long.
Good. Well, we look forward to those. And we want to thank Father Michael Suarez for joining us today.
Thanks very much.